The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
You can donate to the Angel Tree Ministry today via the banner over at HughHewitt.com. And I hope you will. I hope you'll go there. I hope you be as generous as you can. Let me find the number for you, which is right here, because I've got it right in front of me. It's 888-206-2764. 888-206-2764. A gift of $125 benefits 5 children. They get a present. They get a Bible. And they get a handwritten note from mom or dad in jail or prison. And those 3 things make all the difference at Christmas time. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Merry Christmas to you all. I'm joined now by Chris Stewart. Congressman Chris Stewart represents Utah in the United States House of Representatives. Before that, he flew for the Air Force. He flew the B-1B bomber. He's an author of 17 books, many of them bestsellers. He's on Approps. He's on Intel. Congressman Stewart, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Hey, good morning.
I got to know, are you going to put your hand up for the new select committee on China that Leader McCarthy, when he becomes Speaker McCarthy, is going to stand up?
You bet. Kevin and I have already talked about it. I think it's, I told Kevin, as we discussed it before he decided to create the committee, I said, Kevin, I think this is the most important thing you can do, perhaps in your time as Speaker. And I really mean that. I mean, we're at such a critical time with our relationship and our understanding of the rise of China. I look forward to, I hope having a chance to work on that committee.
You know, I am telling you, Congressman, it could be the Kapoffer Commission on Organized Crime, the Kapoffer Committee. It could educate Americans on the sinister nature of this regime and the fact that we, whether we want to be in it or not, we're in a 100-year marathon, to quote Michael Pillsbury. Do you think America is aware yet of the threats all around them posed by the Chinese Communist Party?
No, we're certainly not. The good news is that we're more aware now than we were even just, I think, maybe 5 years ago or so. There's been a sea change in people's attitudes, and you see it in the business community clearly. And part of that is driven by COVID and the response of China to COVID and also realizing our dependence on China. I mean, who knew 3 years ago that 92% of our antibiotics were manufactured in China, or that 96% of our generic drugs we were dependent upon China. So I think that's accelerated it a little bit. But I still talk with business leaders all the time who have no intention of disentangling from China, who really view them as just trusted business partners. And the American people, I think, as well, don't really view them as the threat that they are. And if they knew the malicious nature of the Chinese Communist Party, if they knew not just the threat to the Uyghurs, for example, something that, you know, is easy to talk about, but the threat that they show throughout Africa, throughout South America, throughout some of the weaker and lesser developed nations in Europe. I mean, the list just goes on and on, Hugh.
Oh, they're buying Africa piece by piece. People don't know that, but they're buying Africa piece by piece.
Well, and I think buy is probably a generous description, because they go in and they provide a little bit of funds, a little bit of money, but then they bring in all these Chinese workers to build these docks, for example, or transportation projects. They're all done with Chinese workers, and they indebt these nations. They indebt them to the point of them losing their sovereignty. For example, Djibouti in Northern Africa is a great example of it, how deeply they regret allowing China to come in and build a military base essentially there. And as they've expanded and they've lost sovereignty over their entire nation.
Yeah. While I have your ear, my suggestion to the select committee, to the speaker and every member on it, is to schedule hearings long in advance, hold them at night and tell C-SPAN to come so Americans can decide for themselves whether or not to watch. I certainly will. I'll play them all the next day, and not to be quarreling with the Democrats. In fact, I asked Mike Gallagher yesterday, and he named Congresswoman Spanberger, and he named a couple of other serious Democrats on national security. He did not name Seth Moulton or Jared Golden, who are a couple other serious. Not everyone has to be a veteran, but it sure does help. I also suggested they put on Juan Ciscomani, because having a Spanish-speaking Republican who can take the committee's message onto Spanish media would be very, very useful. Who among the Democrats would you like to see if this thing's really going to work in the common interest to the benefit of all Americans?
Well, I think there's a number of them. I mean, Krishnamoorthy, for example, unfortunately, one that I have tremendous respect for, Peter Welch, who was just elected a senator. And there's a number of others. But I got to go back to your previous point, Hugh, and that is one of the challenges we have on the work that we do on the House Intelligence Committee, which I said, is that it's behind closed doors. It's down to the skiff. We can't talk about it. And that can't be the focus of the new Select Committee on China. It can't focus on the national security or the classified intel part of it. It's got to be open. It's got to be where the American people can see it and hear it. I could not agree with you more on your observation on that point.
Yeah, give us a schedule. Tell us when it's going to be. Be the opposite of the January 6th Rump Committee. Don't manipulate the media. Work with across the aisle. Welcome people in. Don't politicize it. But educate. It's the longest long telegram in history coming. Now, Congressman, you're also on APROPS. And I got to ask you about the NDAA and whether or not it's going to fully fund the Department of Defense. Where are we?
Yeah, I believe it will. And I think it's a good example of where finally, with Republicans taking the House, even by just a razor-thin margin, we're going to be able to exert a little bit of power and authority here in Washington, D.C. Long, long time coming, it seems. But a good example of that is our insistence that they have to pull out the vaccine mandate. This is an example of policy that makes absolutely no sense. And I could give you examples of that. But the bottom line is that the Biden administration has fired our heroes, and it's weakened our military in numerous ways. One of the most obvious being we can't recruit. None of the major branches met their recruitment goals, and the branch chiefs will tell you, yeah, we think that the vaccine mandate is a big part of that. It makes no sense. The threat of COVID is not the same thing as the threat to national security of having an undermanned military.
In fact, Congressman, on that point, do you read Ellis Items every morning? I do. I read it every morning. And today, John Ellis put into Ellis Items the latest stats on the virus and its permutations and its mutation. Seniors, my age and older, we are the only target, right? There are a few people out there that need to get the vaccine 100% because of underlying comorbidities. But it's really about old people. It's not about 18-year-olds joining the military. That is nuts.
It is nuts. So let me give you just two quick examples. A young woman, African-American, and by the way, it's not just the military. It's throughout the intelligence agencies as well. She worked for one of the agencies, highly recruited, incredibly skilled. It will take 5 years to replace her. She was pregnant. She had had multiple miscarriages. All she was asking for was to delay the vaccine until she had delivered her baby in February. They would not allow it. They separated her. That is nuts, not to accommodate
it. It is. Now, let me go to the money, though. Let me go to the money, because Ken Calvert's a buddy of mine. I know he's working around the clock to get the funding up. I think you're going to win on the vaccine mandate. Are we going to build the ships that we need? We need submarines, underwater platforms. We need the B-21, the successor to what you flew. Are you going to fund the Columbia? Are you going to get everything funded?
Yeah, I believe we will. I actually think the funding on this bill is... I don't want to say it's sufficient because it does leave holes, and I guess as a former Air Force officer and defense, someone who works in defense intelligence, there's always things that I think we still need that we perhaps don't get funding for. But by and large, we do the higher priorities. For example, the ships, building out our Navy once again, the B-21, some of the air assets. I think it's actually a good bill, and you're going to have. The vast majority of Republicans are going to support it because of that.
All right. Tell me this nattering that's going on among Matt Gaetz and whoever will talk to him about Kevin not being the speaker. That is so injurious to the United States. I'll never have him on this show for what he's doing. And he said he's never going to vote. Maybe if he changes his mind. And I don't care if anyone ever talks to him again. But are you going to get a majority for the speaker on the first ballot, which he needs? He needs that. We do not need the nattering nabobs of negativism, to borrow from Spiro Agnew, chewing up the GOP majority before it even sits down. What's going on?
And for what purpose? What in the world do these few individuals, what beef do they have with Kevin McCarthy? I mean, what has he done that has so offended them that they go, no, we can't have him be our speaker? And at what price do we pay? What are the American people going to think about Republican leadership if we can't even select our own leader? And by the way, we have voted on a leader. We had free and fair elections. We had several people who put their names in the ring, said, I want to be the speaker. And Kevin was selected. He was overwhelmingly selected, 180 or 190 to 30. There was a democratic process to decide who is going to be our leader. Kevin won resoundingly. And for some of these coneheads to make the issue of this in front of the American people and not give him that vote on the floor, it's so disrespectful to the process. But more than that, to use your word, it's injurious to the American people because it demonstrates a lack of seriousness on the part for the American for the party.
You know, that is a conehead is generous. You don't have to name anyone, but I will say conehead is being generous to Matt Gaetz. And you know what? If you want to repair your image in the United States, you don't do it by being the guy who destroys the momentum of the incoming majority on something as important as the Select Committee and the stuff that's got. I mean, McCarthy's going to be the speaker. I don't know what these people are doing. Talk to me a little bit about what your subcommittees will be on approps, Congressman Chris Stewart.
Hey, before I get to that, can I make a point on what you just said? And that is, I think Kevin's going to win. I think these individuals are going to back down. I think the fact that you're talking about it and other leaders on the right are pointing out how ineffective this is. I think Kevin, although they're going to play it out as long as they can, I think Kevin's going to win on that first.
Let's continue. You know what they're doing? They're feeding the left-wing media's narrative about disarray in the Republican caucus, which does not exist. It just makes me crazy that they cut the legs out of our momentum. But go back to your subcommittees on approps, Chris Stewart.
Well, I think with my background and the great desire I have is continued work on defense and intelligence and national security. So, you know, we think defense is a great one. We're hoping we can be selected on that. It's actually very, very selective. It's probably the hardest committee or subcommittee in all of Congress to get appointed to. But, you know, I represent Utah. I represent Western issues, public lands and interiors.
Water.
Is incredibly important for us. Water, right? Water and energy. I mean, those are very, very important to any Western state.
Congressman Chris Stewart, I hope you will be a regular guest as we go forward. I want every member on that select committee and the Democrats, too. Tell your Democratic friends, I'm not here to ambush them. I'm here to amplify their messages about China, because we are going to make sure, at least we're going to do our part to make sure that select committee gets the attention it must get if the American people are ready for the 100-year marathon. So I hope you keep coming back, Chris Stewart. Thank you for getting up early this morning.
Thank you, sir.
I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway on this December 8th in the year of our Lord 2022. As you know, over the years, I've been critical of Politico because they went so far to the left, but they're coming back to the center with Olivia Beavers. Olivia Beavers is a reporter first, and I actually don't know what her politics are. She's a very good reporter, and she has a great story on Red State Rodeos to set up GOP 2024 races that I want to talk to her about, and about the Select Committee on China. She covers the Hill like very few people do. Good morning, Olivia. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, Olivia, I always ask the same two questions for a first-time guest. Doesn't matter if you don't know the answer, if the answer is no. It's just I did. All right. Question number one, was Alger Hiss a communist spy?
Yes.
Good, good, good. Number two, have you read The Looming Tower?
I have not. It's on my bookshelf.
All right. When you get that done, you'll have a complete, you'll get the A. We'll call that incomplete. Yeah, it's a thick book, but it's so riveting. It's still important, even as our focus turns to China. Before I go to Red State Rodeos, what can you tell me? What's your scoop on the Select Committee on China? Jake Sherman said this week Mike Gallagher will be its chair. Mike Gallagher said he doesn't know that, but they expect 10 Republicans and 7 Democrats. What do you know, Olivia Beavers?
You know, it's been a position that House Republicans have been really excited about. I know that Jim Banks' name was floated for a while, but now as he looks like he's possibly running for Senate, they started to look for a different name. And Gallagher has been someone that McCarthy has really taken an interest in. And, you know, he was recently put on the House Select Intelligence Committee. So it's a sign that McCarthy likes him, and that's why he's putting his name forward. We don't know who Democrats are eyeing for the position, but, you know, the party has China hawks themselves. So, like, think of someone like Gregory Meeks. And, you know, sort of ironically, Nancy Pelosi was, you know, considered a bit of a hawk on China in the party as well. So,
yeah, they can't put this committee has to communicate and be nonpartisan. They can't put Pelosi on it.
No, they won't. But, you know, I think you have to look through it through the guise of they want someone who is also going to be interested in looking into the threat of China. But they will also probably need to be prepared for Republicans to say, you know, the Biden administration is not going hard enough on China. And they're going to have to pick someone that, you know, they believe that will defend the administration and, you know, the Democratic Party in terms of their view on China.
Yeah, I'm looking at Jared Golden up in Maine, the accomplished Marine. I'm looking at Seth Moulton in Massachusetts, also Marine. I know that Spanberger in Virginia is considered a national security serious person. There are lots of good, serious Democrats who will defend the president, but also focus on China. And I really don't care about scoring points on Biden here. I care about getting the American people into the game here. Let's turn to the Red State Rodeo story that you have in Politico. It's very, very good. Montana, Ohio, West Virginia, and Indiana. We covered Indiana. I think if Jim Banks wins, he clears the field. You mentioned Sparks. You mentioned Ruth Ann Green. They will not go against Jim Banks. He will clear the field, and he will be the next senator. So let's focus on the other three. Ohio, I know Matt Dolan. I know Bernie Marino. They both have run before. They got out of the race. Bernie got out. Matt Dolan lost, came in second. They're both well-funded. They're both experienced. I think the other people are nuts to run against them. But who do you think might run against them besides those two?
You know, we heard LaRose coming up, his name mentioned quite a bit. And the people that I talked to thought that he had a very strong chance. You know, they talked about sort of the infrastructure that he has in place, some of the allies. And so they were really saying, you know, we think that he's a strong candidate for the role. But someone who also surprised me was Warren Davidson, who's a Republican in the House. And when I asked him, are you interested in running? He basically said, I will be weighing it. We want to get, you know, the House, you know, the majority underway. We want to be making some of the promises that we made to the American people with commitment to America. And then I will be considering a potential run for that. So, I mean, I imagine you're going to be seeing quite a few names at least perking up and saying I'm interested. Whether or not we see them run, that's a whole different question.
Yeah, you know, Bernie Marino and Matt Dolan, I think they can, if they start sitting down and having conversations, they will clear the field. But it's like Montana, where there are two people with a claim to having run before for a Senate seat and actually or run statewide in Montana, Ryan Zinke and Rosedale. And Ryan Zinke makes more sense to me than Rosedale, but I don't know Rosedale very well. What do you think's going on there?
You know, it's interesting. They're both pretty new to the House. They know each other because, you know, they've had their own run-ins before in terms of running for office. Zinke and Rosendale are sort of different personality-wise if you meet them. Running up, I know Rosendale a little bit better, but I ran up to him and, you know, he gave me the same statement again and again and again, which shows just how rigorous he is in sticking to his statements. But you know, when I ran up to Ryan Zinke to ask him if he's interested, he was joking about steak dinners with John Tester and, you know, very approachable and jolly for this reporter he didn't quite know coming up and asking him what his future plans are.
So, well, you're nice. You've tricked everyone a little. You know, the secret to being a journalist in America is to appear to be nice, right? Isn't that the secret? When we met in the green room, right, we were nice to each other, and that means we'll talk to each other. And if you're nice to your sources, they'll talk to you.
That's true. I'm also, I like to say I'm sort of like that annoying kid growing up who said, I'm not poking you. I just got a little bit less annoying about it.
Olivia, let me ask you, give us your background. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? How'd you get into this job?
Sure. So I grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I had gone back and forth about documentary film, but I actually decided to become a reporter because of a bad news story that impacted my community. I'm not sure if you remember, but a couple years back, the Rolling Stone magazine had a story called A Rape on Campus. And it was And it was about a brutal gang rape. And I remember various different experiences, like mothers going up to my mom and saying, how could you let your daughter go to that school? Me saying that that didn't match my experience, but somehow my opinion was seen as undermining the woman's experience. The echo chamber, the mob mentality of every guy in that fraternity was presumed guilty, even if, you know, the grade that wasn't living in the fraternity at the time was there. And then the story was wrong. And so the national media left and the community was reeling. And I remember feeling really frustrated with just, you know, feeling like a bystander watching that unfold right in front of my eyes. And I thought I can do better. So I embarked on about a year long journey trying to become a reporter after that.
Well, you're at Politico. Does Politico know that you don't have a political portfolio? You don't have a dossier built up in anyone's mind. I mean, you're a blank sheet, right? Talented, smart, energetic, but I don't know if you're going to be biased or not. How do you guard against becoming either pegged like me? I'm a Republican. I've just always been a Republican. I'm just a transparent. My podcast is called The Grand Old Pod, for example. What are you going to do to keep that reputation as fair?
You know, I've never really felt pressure to change my reputation. I have editors who are great. You know, sometimes I'll say like, hey, like, I think we need to tweak this. And they're really responsive to me. And I find like Washington, D.C. is such a small town, right? And I was told very early on into my career, if you're unfair, the word will travel and no one will want to talk to you. But if you're fair and, you know, you give people a heads up and say, hey, you know, you're not going to like the story, give me a statement, then they will forgive you even if they don't love the story initially. So, you know, I think like this town is so small, your word matters. And that's something that I've tried to build my career upon.
Now, Olivia, I want to go back to the China Select Committee because I want to encourage you to own that story. I think Gallagher will be the chair. Jake Sherman told me that. I think Mike Waltz will be on it. I think Chris Stewart will be on it. I think there will be a number of Republicans on, and the Democrats like Seth Moulton and Jared Golden and Spanberger, the rest, whoever they are, whoever covers this, it is the new Kefauver Committee. It is the new Watergate Committee. It's going to matter. Do you get to go to your editor and say, I want to invest in this committee? Is that possible?
Oh, totally. And I think we would also probably share it across, you know, reporters who are more focused on national security as well. And, you know, the members that you mentioned, it's good to keep in mind, Gallagher, Waltz, Chris Stewart, you know, there's a difference between showmanship and the members who are really sort of serious about national security. And those are all names that people of members who will take this really seriously. They are usually people who put their head down and are considered very, you know, experts in their field. I covered Chris Stewart back when he was on the House Intelligence Committee, and still do because I cover House Republicans quite a bit. But, you know, I think that you're going to see a lot of probably good work across the aisle from this.
Are those three, in your opinion, great communicators? Because I think we need communicators as well as national security. They've got to be effective, charismatic people from the podium. Those three examples of that?
They are, but they're communicators in different ways. I think, you know, Gallagher is accessible, but he will say that he will have days where he's willing to do interviews and days where he will want to ignore you. And Mike Waltz is used to me bugging him persistently day in and day out, and he will usually be able to throw me a quote. And Chris Stewart is very approachable as well. And I think he is a good communicator in terms of laying out his arguments and vision.
Kevin McCarthy has got this plan, and boy, does America need it. And we also need reporters like Olivia Beavers to cover it. And so she'll be back here. Nonpartisan, fair and balanced, Olivia Beavers. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. This is Dwayne Patterson, producer of The Hugh Hewitt Show. I've known for a while now that there's been far too much of me here in the studio, and I finally needed to do something about my weight. My excuse was always that I couldn't follow a plan with the crazy schedule that I keep. I heard about PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition and how they customize their program for each client, and I decided to call. This was no problem for Rachel and the PhD team. They had me map out what my day looks like and created a plan to follow. And so far, I've lost 16 pounds already, and I'm just 2 weeks in on the way to my goal of losing 45. Call PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition at 864-644-1900 and make your appointment for your consultation. The plan is simple. It's based on science and nutrition. There's no pills or injections, and they even include 80% of your food if you want it. Call them right now at 864-644-1900 or find them online at myphdweightloss.com and tell them you heard about it from Dwayne. The producer Hugh actually has on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
But they couldn't stop Jack or the horses happy. And they couldn't prevent Jack from feeling happy.
Welcome to the Grand Old Pod, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, the host of the Grand Old Pod. It's actually the third edition of the Grand Old Pod, but I called it GOP News while we were clearing the intellectual property. And yeah, you got to do that. If you start a podcast and the title is gone, and Grand Old Pod is a great title. GOP, right? Grand Old Party, Grand Old Pod. You can remember Grand Old Pod, but you can only listen to it if you're a member of the universe. So the Grand Old Pod is now named, and I'll be standing up the Grand Old Pod website to get you to the Grand Old Pod subscription service, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the Grand Old Pod is about Republican news by a Republican for Republicans and any Democrats who might be interested in what Republicans really think. And by Republicans, I usually mean 90% thereof. There are some Republicans who are way over on the left side of the party about whom I don't have much to say. And there are some Republicans who are way over on the right-hand side of the party, and I don't have much to say. I very rarely name them on either extreme. I did on the radio show on Thursday, because Matt Gaetz is screwing up the easy transition, which should be a lateral speaker's gavel to Kevin McCarthy. And he's not going to screw it up in the end. Speaker McCarthy is coming. They just want attention. They just want attention. And they're grieving. They're trying to negotiate when they ought to be focused on the future of the country and they ought to be focused on the future of the party. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I'm just going to say Kevin McCarthy is the overwhelming selection of members of the House elected from all 50 states. I guess they don't have one in Alaska because the Democrat went up there because Sarah Palin got rejected. But that'll eventually become a Republican seat again. And we got two great Republican senators from Alaska. But the Grand Old Pod is about Republicans. Now, I can't do my radio show every day about Republican news. I can't do it, but I can do this podcast every day. And yeah, I expect that every member of Congress comm staff will be a member. And I imagine only one person will join per office because they don't want to pay the freight for the universe. But you got to be a member of the universe if you want to listen to the Grand Old Pod. So while we might put one out there as a freebie to let people know that the Grand Old Pod exists, and that might be today, I don't want you to think I'm just going to keep giving away, because we're not. This takes a lot more work. It's a second show prep to do the Grand Old Pod. And while we're involved in the wildest 2024 presidential race ever, it's already got former President Donald Trump declared. It's going to have Governor Greg Abbott, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, former South Carolina Governor and UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, former Vice President Mike Pence, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Florida Senator Rick Scott, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, and Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin. I mean, they're going to be, I've got Google alerts on them to find out, okay, what are they up to? Are any of them in New Hampshire or Iowa today? I follow the news about them and the news, for example, out of the Washington Post today about the Senate map in 2024, which is very favorable to the Republicans. In 1968, when Richard Nixon won a very hotly contested primary to become the Republican presidential nominee, and then an even more difficult general election, three-way, George Wallace representing the Dixiecrats, the segregated South, and Hubert Humphrey, the vice president who got in when and beat the field that remained after Robert Kennedy was assassinated, Richard Nixon in 1968 won five Senate seats in a very deeply divided country. So I expect the Republican nominee to carry over because the map is so good for Republicans. If they don't screw it up, if they elect good candidates to run in the general election of 2024, Leader McConnell will become Majority Leader McConnell again. And that's Montana and Ohio and West Virginia. Those are the three states carried by Donald Trump twice that have a Democrat senator on the ballot in 2024. And there are great experienced candidates in Montana, Ohio, and West Virginia. And I'll be talking to them throughout, and I'll be telling you about them and about the House of Representatives and how you build the majority if you're Kevin McCarthy, and how people ought to go to WinRed and contribute at WinRed. And I will try and repeat every single day on the Grand Old Pod, do not give to PACs. Do not answer the emails from third parties that you've never heard of. Do not call 1-800-RE-ELECT-SOMEBODY. Do not do that. Go to WinRed or go to find the actual campaign of whoever you want to support in whatever race. Do not throw your money away at PACs, which are grifter operations. You'll never hear me send you to a grifter operation. They're run by consultants for consultants and benefit. Like the Lincoln Project, the all-time grifter project forever. And I mean, not only is it scandalized, not only did John Weaver turn out to be a creep, and I didn't know that when he was running John Kasich's campaign for president, but he turned out to be a creep, and Steve Schmidt turned out to be just not balanced, and Rick Wilson's always been funny, and he was a guest on this show, but he's in this for the money now, and Ed Rollins is really in it for the money now. Don't give money to those people. Listen to the Grand Old Pod every day, and I'll tell you who the real candidates are and what they're really doing and what's going on in Republican news. And it's about Republicans. So I want to go there today. First of all, I want to do this story. TikTok is sued by the state of Indiana, accused of targeting young teens with adult content. Why is this a Republican story? Because the Republicans own the China issue. We got there first under Donald Trump, especially when Mike Pompeo was running. By the way, is he on my list? Do I even have Mike Pompeo on my list? I don't have Mike Pompeo on my list. Oh, my gosh. The former Secretary of State's going to shoot me. And he can. He's a very good soldier. Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is also running for president. So when Pompeo got there as CIA director, he began to warn the Trump White House. And when he became Secretary of State and replaced Rex Tillerson, he sat down with Attorney General William Barr and the Vice President and Robert O'Brien and Christopher Wray. And they gave a series of five speeches, beginning with Vice President Pence, but followed by Chris Wray, Bill Barr, Robert O'Brien, and then concluding with Mike Pompeo at the Nixon Library to repeal the China Doctrine that Richard Nixon hatched, but which had been overtaken by events, meaning the increasing totalitarian nation and threat posed by China. And that now come out. And I notice Republican states are leading the way. Larry Hogan, governor of Maryland, went out last week and said, we are not going to let TikTok operate in Maryland. They're gone. And he named a bunch of other people, too, like WeChat. They're not going to be here because they're gathering information from the dossiers that they're putting together. And now Indiana, run by Republicans for Republicans, to the benefit of everyone in Republican land, that is Indiana, they're not known for much, right? Indiana's not known for much, but they got common sense. They got common sense. And Mike Pence just embodied that in his new book, which is up here. His memoir is up here somewhere. What's it called? I Solemnly Swear or My Oath. What's it called? I got it here. There's Cotton's book. He's not running. I got John Kerry's memoir up there, and I got Hillary Rodham Clinton's memoir up there. I must have given away Mike Pence's book. But So Help Me God, that's what it is. I'm remembering it. So Help Me God. He talks about Indiana politics, and good for Indiana. Good for whoever put this into place. Suing TikTok because they're exploiting young people is a very good thing for every attorney general to do in every state, but especially for Republican attorney general. Now, a couple of bits of news that I think are very interesting. In case you missed it, this story is from scott.senate.gov. Senator Tim Scott receives Federal Law Enforcement Foundation's National Service Award. Why does this matter? Last week, U.S. Senator Tim Scott attended the Federal Law Enforcement Foundation's 34th annual luncheon and award ceremony as the keynote speaker and recipient of the organization's National Service Award. He discussed his positive experiences with our nation's law enforcement community, the current crime epidemic, and our partnership with law enforcement leaders on police funding and reform efforts. It was a great speech. It was a great bit of, well, Tim Scott doesn't give bad speeches. Tim Scott's a gifted orator. Tim Scott's running for president. He may not win the nomination. He might win the nomination, but he's going to be on the ticket. Unless he's the nominee, in which case I think he'll reach down to his neighbor in Arkansas, Tom Cotton, who will fulfill the traditional role of vice presidential nominees. Nikki Haley would do the same. Anyone who's not a white male, and maybe some who are white males, are going to reach out and say, Cotton, we want Cotton. Why? Because what Richard Nixon did for Eisenhower, Cotton will do for whomever the nominee in 2024 is. Just savage the Democrats on national security and on military preparedness, and he'll be right. And Senator Cotton took himself out of the race because he didn't want to spend 2 years away from his boys and from his wife. But go to the ticket in July or August at Milwaukee in 2024. You betcha. You betcha he'll do that. And he will do exactly what vice presidents have always done. George H.W. Bush, when he was running with Ronald Reagan, and Nixon, when he was running with Eisenhower. Agnew, when he was running with Nixon, was the attack dog. And you got to have one. And Kamala Harris sort of tried to be that, but she's so bad at it, she wasn't very good at it. And it was a very close election because she was, in so many respects, such a terrible candidate. So Tim Scott, keep your eye on Tim Scott. I said this, by the way, about Senator Harris. Even when she got off to the worst start ever of a would-be president and ran a horrible campaign and was out before the first vote was cast, Kamala Harris imploded. But I kept saying in the Washington Post again and again and again and again, she's going to be on the national ticket. She's going to be on the national. There is nobody else to do the job that needs to be done, which is mobilize the Black African-American vote that might otherwise sit on the sidelines. You got to get that extra 3%, 4%, 5% going who say, you know, there, we had President Obama, now we step backward, we can't have an all-white ticket. Kamala Harris came along. Now, I deplore racial politics, but I know it works, and I know that consultants worry about demographic and race diversity in national tickets and in national parties. So Kamala Harris was put on the ticket because she had to be on the ticket, and Tim Scott's going to be on the ticket because he's got to be on the ticket. Maybe Nikki Haley, maybe, because of demographic diversity, if it's a white male at the top of the ticket. One of those two, but I'm going to follow Tim Scott very closely and Nikki Haley as well. Now I want to turn to the last story of today's GO, Grand Old Pod. Grand Old Pod. After restaurant raid, Youngkin says state should stop enforcing COVID-19 restrictions. I think, did you probably didn't hear this story because it's in the Foxware.com news. And he just said, we're done with that. And he's told Virginia State Enforcement Authority, we're not doing COVID lockdown anymore. Even if you've got rules on the books, even if you think someone's violating your local rules and your local ordinance, stop it. We're not going to do that anymore. Moreover, Glenn Youngkin proposed refunding fines from the COVID years to business owners in the state of Virginia. I think that is fabulous. I think every Republican governor ought to study up on the Youngkin playbook and go back and say, nobody wanted to, but everyone made mistakes. Everybody made mistakes, from President Trump and Vice President Pence and every member of HHS and Secretary Azar and Secretary everybody. Everybody made mistakes. Tony Fauci made a lot of them. Francis Collins made a lot of them. The state governors made a lot of them. Everybody made mistakes because we were afraid. If COVID had actually had lethality for other than seniors or people with very intense comorbidities, our million deaths would have been 10 million deaths. And we didn't know at the beginning, so we overreacted. And that's just the long and the short of COVID, the horrors of COVID in 2020 and 2021. Figuring out what was going on, getting a vaccine developed, we threw people out of the military. We shouldn't have done that. They're fixing that in the NDAA. Glenn Youngkin is the first governor not only to say we made mistakes, but to act on the fact that mistakes were made and start refunding money and stop the and suspend and repeal ticky-tack enforcement actions under the name of COVID, because we're done with that. We are not afraid of COVID anymore. You can either live your life without the vaccine or with the vaccine and the boosters. I'm in the latter category. A lot of people listen to the show and are going to listen to Grand Old Potter in the former. And to let 1,000 flowers bloom, we know what the risks are. We now have the treatments. We've also got Paxlovid, and we're going to develop new ones. And you get to make your choice because you're a free American. You're not living in China, and even China's had to repeal that stuff. But Glenn Youngkin is ahead of that. I also have another story here from cardinalnews.org. Again, I look for Republican news on the Grand Old Pod. Governor Youngkin says he wants all high school students to graduate with college-level associate degrees. Right now, less than 3% do. In other words, he's in favor of dual enrollment. Governor Glenn Youngkin has repeatedly said he wants all Virginia high school students to graduate with college-level associate degrees that will prepare them for the workforce. So far, though, he hasn't said how that will be possible or how much it will cost the Commonwealth to basically pay for 2 years' worth of college credits for every student in Virginia. Right now, less than 3% of Virginia's public high school seniors are on track to graduate with a two-year degree when they leave high school. But by December 15th, it being today, December 8th, Youngkin is going to announce his budget priorities, and he is going to do the joint money committees. He will announce to them his proposal to move Virginia in the right direction. He announced it at the Virginia Economic Summit and Forum on International Trade in Richmond. And do you see that once again, he's out in front? Like DeSantis in Florida is out in front, like Abbott out in front. They pick issues on which they want to lead because they're getting ready to run. And I think Glenn Youngkin's going to run for president. I do. You know, he's term limited. You can't run for governor more than once in Virginia unless you take 4 years off. And that rarely works out, as Terry McAuliffe, who Youngkin beat. And he's making education his centerpiece. He's also going back and fixing the mistakes of the COVID years. But by making the associate degree a goal of every high school student, he's going to return vocational high school to the world. Now, when I went to high school 1,000 years ago, I graduated from John F. Kennedy High School in Warren, Ohio in 1974. We had shop. We also had a vocational high school over in Lordstown, funded by GM in the days when GM actually cared about Ohio, that every high school student in Trumbull County could go to. You want to be an auto mechanic? You want to be a welder? You want to be a lineman? Then you go over and you go to the Trumbull County Vocational High School, which may still be operating. I don't know. And you did that after, and you did it at the same time you were going to high school at, you know, Kennedy or Harding or Nile, or you were in Trumbull County. You would just go get your associate degree courses so you could come out as a welder. You can come out as someone trained as an apprentice in the electrical trade. You could come out ready to work because some people don't want to go to college. And I am all with them. I told my kids, if this isn't for you, don't do it. They all went. They're all gainfully employed. They all launched. We did not have a failure to launch. And that's great. Failure to launch is not a bad thing, by the way, if you're spending the time at an associate degree and you're still living at home and you're saving money and you're not going to college and getting that associate degree. I talked to my son's father-in-law, and my son's father-in-law is active in the North Carolina community college world. Do you know that one community college in North Carolina graduates more linemen than any other facility in the United States? Linemen. You know what linemen do? And line women. You know what they do? Really hard work in the middle of really difficult circumstances, and it's dangerous. And you just don't walk in and say, I'm ready to be a lineman for the county. If I had a producer, we'd have some Glenn Campbell playing right now. You just don't show up and become a lineman. I thought maybe I heard that, but you know, not even Adam's that quick. But if you want to be a lineman and you're in North Carolina, you want to go to his community college and you want to get certified in how to be a lineman. Now, that's got nothing to do with learning the core curriculum at Hillsdale College. It ain't got anything to do with Euclid. It ain't got anything to do with Thucydides. There we go.
And the Wichita lineman.
I suppose Adam would like it if I gave him a little bit of a warning, wouldn't he? Being a lineman is a great job. And when you see a hurricane approaching Florida and you see all those linemen driving from everywhere in the United States and parking their cars and getting ready to roll out, that's because people know what to do and they don't electrocute themselves and they get power back up. By the way, they help everybody out. There are these reciprocal agreements everywhere. But I digress, which I do a lot on the Grand Old Pod because I don't have commercial breaks and I don't have to worry about that stuff. I get to just talk to you about Republican Party news and what's going on. What Youngkin has done in planting a flag on community college education is huge. And again, the Republicans running in 2024, whether for the presidency or the Senate or in Congress, are going to be laser focused on China and education, China and education, China and education, because we're in a fight for our lives with China. And I'm going to close by talking about the Select Committee on China. It's my last Grand Old Pod of the week. It's Thursday. The Grand Old Pod is available Monday through Thursday. Over at the universe. And Monday through Thursday, I don't do it on Friday. 4 days a week, you get the Grand Old Pod. And when I come back next week, I'll even know more about the Select Committee on China that soon-to-be Speaker Kevin McCarthy is standing up. I think it's going to be chaired by Mike Gallagher. I think it's going to include Chris Stewart, Michael Waltz, and other Republicans who are serious about national security and know how to communicate. And I hope Hakeem Jeffries, who's replaced Nancy Pelosi, puts serious people on there who know how to communicate and work across the aisle. China is every American's adversary. They're not an enemy because we're not at war, but boy, are they spying a lot more than the Soviets ever did. And I know a little bit about what the Soviets did because that's what I did at the Department of Justice in 1983 and 1984. I did the applications for surveillance on Russian spies and East German spies and Cuban spies. There weren't many Chinese spies back then. I can't talk much about what we did, but I know that game and I know what the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court does, and I know that we are active in that and that the Chinese today make the Soviets in the 80s seem like kiddies. It's like playground. They are so much more avaricious for they're just greedy as can be for information about every American and every American company. And the Chinese graduate students who are in the United States ought to be thrown out. And anyone who's working with the Chinese government ought to be told, stop working with the Chinese government. And this China committee is going to alert us to the challenges ahead and hopefully support our effort to get back in the game to stay ahead of China. We are still ahead of China. We got some tricks up our sleeve that I've heard about that China kind of knows about, but they don't really know about. Like, we can blink out China immediately. I don't mean physically. I don't mean destroyed. I mean just turn out the power. We can do that. And We may do that. They invade Taiwan. That may be the thing that we do. We can do that. And maybe they can do that to us, by the way. I'm not sure. I'm told that we have some pretty healthy countermeasures in place against Chinese cyber espionage. But the fact of the matter is this China committee is going to matter a lot. And the congressmen who are on it are going to be big stars in the GOP. And everyone running for president has got to be prepared to talk about that and talk about it persuasively. So I conclude where I began today's grand old pod with the TikTok story in Indiana. Get on it, Republicans everywhere. Get TikTok out of the United States. Republican Attorney Jones, get it out of the United States. Republicans in Congress, put the attention on it. And parents who are listening to grand old pod, take your kid's phone, remove TikTok from it. You probably have to buy a new phone, probably dirtied up by malware. You put TikTok on it, you got the malware, probably. Don't know that for sure. TikTok USO, that's not us. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. If you belong to ByteDance, you are owned by the Chinese Communist Party. No ands, ifs, or buts about that. That's the reality of what a Chinese Communist Party operates like. And I want you to be aware of the reality, because you want to, if you're listening to Grand Old Pod. We're also going to add at the end of this Grand Old Pod, that which I'm putting on the regular, highly concentrated Hugh Free Pod, which is supported by advertising, that interview with Russell Levinson, which I did this morning, about the book Witness to Dignity. What a magnificent book. I want you to listen to that interview. So we're going to add it to the Grand Old Pod in the event that you missed it earlier and you're just listening to the Grand Old Pod and you haven't got highly concentrated Hugh for the day.
Joy to the world, the Lord is come. Let earth receive her King. Let
Welcome back, America. Everyone who's listening on AM 1070 in Houston right now knows that St. Martin's in Houston is the largest Episcopal church in America. They also probably know that St. Martin was a soldier, then a priest, then a monk, then a hermit, and then unfortunately became a bishop. And I think probably even then he thought, oh gosh, do I have to be a bishop? I am joined by the pastor of St. Martin's from Houston, the Right Reverend Russell Levinson, who has written this magnificent, and I don't use that word very often, book, Witness to Dignity, The Life and Faith of George H.W. and Barbara Bush. He joins me now. Father Levinson, good morning. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning, Hugh. Thank you for having me on. I'm delighted to be with you. However, the Right Reverend would be a bishop, and you're right. I wouldn't want to be a bishop.
do you know John Taylor, the bishop in L.A.? He's my old friend from Nixon years long ago. I don't know if that is that the same Episcopal church as you're in?
I don't know him. I don't know him.
So. Well, he's the bishop of L.A., and I think when you get appointed bishop, your life just sort of goes crazy. I am glad you're not, because otherwise you wouldn't have written this book. And Witness to Dignity is a powerful portrait of the former president and former first lady, but it's also an apologetic that is uniquely, see, it's just got like this superpower apologetic in it. Did you intend that?
I think to some degree at the beginning, Hugh, I did. But I think as I moved further along toward the end, I absolutely then thought, well, this needs to be part of the story. And in fact, and I appreciate all your kind words. Those are wonderful words. But I wrote, I think it's chapter 17 or 18 was the kind of a closing chapter on the current state of where things are in our culture and our country with the divisiveness and all that, and that the Bush's lives and the way they live their lives was an invitation to consider doing business in a different way. But when I finished, I actually finished the book. I walked in the other room and I told my wife, I said, well, I just finished, but that's kind of a downer. So I think I want to add a chapter on what Christians believe about life after death. And so I completely finished. Then I went back and added that last chapter
because I'm very grateful.
Bush's firmly believed in life after death. And I thought, well, what a better way to end than that?
Will you tell the story? I'm going to get to the Bushes. And I had to wrestle this book away from the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt because we both love H.W. and Barbara. And we know some members of the family, and his nephew Jamie is a very good friend of mine, and his grandnephew is my godson. So everyone should know I'm pro Bush at the beginning of this thing, and now they got a Episcopal priest in the family, and Sam Bush. I don't know if you know that, but he's just been ordained and is ministering in Charlottesville. I got to ask you, when you wrote this, did anyone in the family think, even for a moment, maybe we don't want the priest telling the story of the suffering, because it's the suffering is enormous, actually.
No, I think when I did ask the children, all of them, you know, could I move down this road? They said yes, but of course they said we do want to see it. You know, we want to see the finished product or draft before it goes off. And so I sent that off, and nobody had any changes. And the president and Barbara were so open and opaque in many ways, transparent in many ways. And I think part of the story is that they, you know, they showed others how to even age with dignity and die with dignity. And I think people wanted to know that piece of their lives. And I wanted them to know that. So I think the family was very supportive. If I ever ran up against something, I thought, well, should I include this? I would actually send it to family members and say, are you okay with me including this? And they gave it the thumbs up. So.
Well, it's remarkably candid and open. And Marvin's note to you, I've only met Marvin once, but his note to you is certainly a ratification of that. And I don't know Neil at all, but I got to say, Neil reading to his father in his last days, it kind of brings a tear to your eyes. And I wonder, why do you think people who are approaching the end of this life on the threshold of the next want to be read to so much?
I think in part the president and Barbara, they loved reading. Of course, that was Mrs. Bush's legacy, is her literacy piece. But I think hearing the voice of loved ones when perhaps you don't have the ability to pick up and hold a book for a long period of time. You know, I don't think I ever saw either of them into audible books. You know, I never saw them with headphones in their ears listening. So I think they like to hear, have the hard copy in their hands or have somebody close by. And it was a way just of filling in a precious, and I mean that precious time to have. And frankly, Neil did that not at the end. He did that. He started that process about a year and a half, 2 years before the president passed away. He would come over in the afternoons and read when he was in town almost every day. If he was in town, Neil would come over to the house. He lived right across the street and read to the president.
What a wonderful example. If anyone reads this book, they will know. Look, I'm going to learn about H.W. and Barr, but I'm going to learn about how to take care of aging parents. I mean, that's really part of this mission of this book is what do you do? I'm going to give it to all my kids. And, okay, when I, you know, if I have a long going, here's what you do. You act like George, Jeb, Marvin, Doro, and Neil. And I got them the order mixed up, but that's what you do. I mean, isn't it amazing that, and the children reflect their parents raising, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. You know, they're all still very involved in service and self-sacrifice, even in, when 43 stepped away from office, that didn't mean he stopped serving others. And the governor who wrote the foreword of the book, Jeb, very much involved in education initiatives. You're right. All the children, Durrell Marshall, they all are very involved in continuing to live out the way their parents would have wanted them to, which is to continue to serve as long as you can up until the end.
Everyone has a favorite anecdote in a book. Everyone will read a book and the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt will have a different favorite anecdote. But mine is the fact you'd get a call most Sundays when he was president from George H.W. Bush checking up on the people at St. Martin's. And by the way, that's church. I'm a Roman Catholic. My wife is a Presbyterian, and I also served as a Presbyterian elder. And our church blew up in the church battles of the last 10 years. You know, PCUSA blew up. And so it doesn't exist anymore. And it's a hole in the soul, right? But what H.W. did when he would call you on Sunday afternoon, he's just keeping his church close to him, wasn't he?
Right. So that was the first rector of St. Martin's back in those days, Tom Bagby, and then his successor, Claude Payne. But absolutely continued to stay in touch with those fellows. I've been here 15 years. The church is relatively young, 70 years old, but I'm the fourth senior pastor. But he was, he stayed in touch with each of the pastors over the years, rectors over the years. And I think, often whenever we would visit together, if I'd come in and if it had been a while, if he had been to Maine and coming back to Houston or we were going up to Maine, he would always say, now, how are things going at the church? And he always liked to say, now, we're still the largest Episcopal church, right?
We are. Is Charles Kraft still alive, by the way?
He is.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Kraft, you have presented a picture of diplomacy with non-believers that ought to be emulated everywhere. You want to tell people about that?
Yeah. So Charles Kraft was a member of the vestry, the governing board of the church. And Madeline Murray O'Hare had showed up with a bevy of her atheistic protesters and showed up at the church one day. And I actually decided, because the president was giving an address in the church, and decided they were going to, you know, protest the president, protest the church, protest our faith. And so the rector, who was busy with the president, sent Charles out to the street corner to say, Ms. O'Hare, you know, I just want to ask you a question or two as you all protest here. Do you believe in the separation of church and state? She said, well, of course we do. And as I say in the book, kind of with a bellicose response. And he said, well, now see here, the sidewalk, this part right here is that's state. And this part over here, right on the other side of the sidewalk, that's church. And so there's the separation, and just keep that in mind as you're protesting. But if you'd like to come in and worship with us, we'd be delighted to have you with us. And then at some point she held up a letter and said, well, I have a letter for the president. And Charles said, well, we're not the post office. That happens to be down the street. So if you want to deliver that to the post office, I'm sure they'll take care of it for you.
It's so winsome. That's the way to deal. Yeah. I mean, you must have had to deal with that repeatedly in your years when HW was there and when the other Bushes were there. Let me talk about something that I think will encourage many people to buy this. If they've experienced loss of a child, there is a story in Witness to Dignity about a mother whose child is dying of leukemia on the couch who asks, what happens? Would you tell that story, Father Levinson?
Yeah, you mean Barbara's, the death of Robin.
Yeah. Well, Rob, no, well, I'm talking about the refrigerator when the mom walks in and sees her.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. At the end of the book. Yeah. That was in the portion where I reflected on what Christians believe about life after death. And Peter Marshall, the great senator, of the Senate chaplain many years ago, used to tell this story that mother was in reading to her son who was dying and very weak. And he used to play outside and, you know, like little boys do. But as this disease progressed, he had to come inside and she would read to him. And she was in the middle of reading a story to her son about the Knights of the Round Table. And they were talking about battles and soldiers dying in battle, et cetera. And her son kind of looked at her and said, Mom, what do you think it's like to die? And she knew exactly why he was asking the question. And she kind of patted him and said, well, give me just a minute. She goes out to the kitchen and the house and literally kneels down and prays. How do I answer this? My son. And she opens her eyes and looks up, and on the refrigerator, there's a picture of her son with her older son, his older brother. And so she comes back out, sits back down with her son and says, you know, honey, you asked me, what do you think? What is it like to die? And I don't know. I haven't died, but I suspect it's something like this. And you remember when you were strong and healthy and you would go out and play in the afternoons and you would come in. Some of those afternoons, you were so tired, you just fall asleep on the sofa. And I didn't have it in me to wake you up because I knew how much you needed your sleep. And so I would have your older brother take you in his arms and carry you upstairs and put you in your pajamas and lay you down in your bed and you would go to sleep. And you would then wake up, you know, the next morning, still in your home, but in a different room. And she said, I think it's something like that. We go to sleep in one room of our father's house. And we wake in another room in our father's house. I think that's probably what it's like.
It's a beautiful story in a beautiful book. Now I want to talk about HW and Barbara for a second. I did not know. I know a lot about the Bush presidency and the first family. And I didn't know that he crashed twice. I thought he only crashed once until I read your book. So, right. You know, there's a reason why portraits need to be written. This is not a definitive authoritative biography like the Meacham. This is a portrait of people that you pastored and you put in there enough that we get stuff that we didn't know. And I didn't know about Barb being a Presbyterian. I didn't know about Barbara Bush being a Presbyterian. And I didn't know that the former president had crashed twice into the drink. Mm-hmm. He must have felt blessed forever.
I think he did. And I do think particularly that the one that we all know about, that you hear a lot about, that when his two comrades died in that plane crash. And you know, there have been a lot of stories where he kind of was bobbing around in the Pacific. And you know, at that time, just thinking about being rescued. But then he's rescued and pulled on the fin back, submarine fin back. And then at 19 years old, is asking not, you know, why did I make it? He's also not partying because he's back on the boat. Maybe he did. I don't know. But he started asking at 19 years old, why did God spare me? And I think that's an important perspective. I think that kind of set the bar for him. And he began to ask that question. And as I said, there've been all people said was he would joke in the end of his life, "Well, he spared me to be married to Barr." Although I don't think that was a joke. I think that was a serious, you know, but I do think, you know, he was rescued, got on the boat, spent some time on that boat rescuing other sailors. And he asked himself, why did God spare me? And I think he asked that question a lot throughout his life. Why? I'm here for a purpose. God has me here on planet Earth for a purpose. And we all mercifully got to see that purpose play out in his life.
Do you remember when Newsweek had the Wimp Factor cover?
Yeah.
And I always think about that when I
actually have a copy of that magazine. I kept that in my office. So, yeah, I do remember that.
Isn't that crazy? Isn't that the craziest thing you could ever put about George H.W. Bush after you know anything about his life?
Right. Tremendously courageous man, and in all kinds of ways. Unfortunately, people associate things like kindness and gentility with being a wimp. And yeah. He was kind, gentle, but he was not a wimp. You know, he led the world. Led the world. Didn't just lead our nation. Led the world.
During the roughest patch where it could have gone so wrong, when the Soviet Union is falling apart and it dissolves officially in 91, the wall comes down in 89, I think, but the Soviet Union hangs around for two more years, and it's James Baker and George H.W. Bush's great accomplishment that they managed that. But he also went to war, and you're right about that. And you're his pastor when he goes to war, and that's a burden, isn't it?
Yep. And I think I was actually with Secretary Baker this last weekend. We were hunting together in South Texas. So at age 92, he is fit and still out there and very active. So
well, he's a Marine,
but
he's a Marine.
That's exactly right. Semper Fi. So whenever, even when we're together, Secretary Baker will reflect on those moments, as if they were yesterday. And, a lot of people, perhaps some people know, but I don't think a lot of people know that as the president prepared to go to war with Kuwait, in Kuwait against Iraq, that he and Secretary Baker, who is an active member of St. Martin's as well and a very faithful Christian man, very carefully not only reviewed what human rights groups were saying, what the Red Cross was saying about the atrocities that were going on there, but they also worked their way through the Augustinian just war theory, which has seven steps.
And it's in this book, by the way. It's a footnote in Witness to Dignity, which I did not expect to find, Augustinian just war doctrine. Well done.
And they prayed about it, and they sought the counsel of other clergy. That just kind of cut it. One of the things I think I learned more and more in our years together, but also in reading and preparing for the book, is I do think some people in the public square use their faith for political reasons. I mean, yep. they kind of, and to further, they get with a certain group or they, you know, show up at a certain gathering and they speak the language of the people to further their career, their vocation. I don't think the president did that other than what normal people running for office do. I do think he was very much, he and Barbara were very much shaped by their faith. And so they believed, they were active in their church, they walked with their Lord. And as a fruit of that, then that played out in the policy making and the service and the public lives that they lived, not just in the White House years, but in the years after the White House.
You know, Father Levinson, I have looked for, and maybe you have it. I haven't been able to find it. It was either in Forbes or Fortune. H.W. wrote a story on how to be an ex-president. And the first line of it was disappear. And the second one that I remember is raise a lot of money for everything that's good. And that's what he did. I mean, he went around everywhere raising a lot of money for people. And he did it in a very quiet, so did Mrs. Bush. No, but it's very relevant, not just disappear. It's a hard thing to lose the presidency. I can't imagine it. Richard Nixon, who I knew very well, lost it and it changed him and he came back. But H.W. didn't want to come back. He wanted to go serve people. Did you counsel him on that?
There was very little I counseled him on. We talked a lot, and I would get his counsel from time to time, and particularly when we were doing big things at the church, which we did a number of those in the last decade plus. But and I would usually first go to them if it was going to be anything that I wondered how it would impact the community, because people knew it was the president's church as well. But I think I learned pretty early on that they lived that mantra. They were not going to talk about who was in office. When you probably thought they were disappointed in the outcome of an election, they didn't want to stoke that fire much. They always felt like we should pray for whoever was in office, whether they voted for them or not.
Avoided the big eye. And people have to, if they don't know what that means, they avoided the big eye. I want to call out, before we run out of time, again, the book is Witness to Dignity. Father, has anyone told you the Luntz rule that you got to say the title of the book, Witness to Dignity, 7 times in any interview, or that no one will remember to buy Witness to Dignity? So just keep saying Witness to Dignity.
My literary agent told me I was supposed to do that. So, but you've taken care of that for me. So
But I also want to take care and thank you on behalf of everyone who has ever served anyone who is declining in health for calling out Evan Sisley and especially Gene Becker, because when you are served by servants like that, the going is easier. And boy, these two are heroes. I don't even know either of these. I've never heard of them. I knew that Gene Becker was around, but I didn't know who it was. Tell people what they did for these older people whom they served.
Sure. Gene Becker was his chief of staff here in Houston and really worked with him, of course, every single day and became a very good friend over the years. And in the early years was kind of my go-to when we had questions or conversation about what was happening in the president's life, or if we wanted to have an event where we wanted him at church, although he was always at church. Evan Sisley was the president's medical aide. And in the early years, he always had kind of a right-hand person. And when he first was diagnosed with Parkinsonian syndrome, he had a medical aide. But in the last several years, Evan Sisley, who was a veteran, became his right-hand medical aide and was at his elbow all the time. And in those last days with Barbara, was there basically round the clock, and the same with the president. And while I might get a call from Neil or Gene, usually it was Evan. And in the last week or two of both of their lives, I would check in with Evan once or twice a day. And it was usually when I got the call to come, we felt like it was the end. It was from Evan. And then, you know, he was there around the clock as we got into the funerals. He was just incredible people. And I think they, much as we, you know, all did who were around the president, loved them so much. The other day was the fourth anniversary of the burial of the president. And I kind of pinged Evan and Gene, and I said, can you believe it's been 4 years since we were all together for that great man? And all of us said the time had flown by, but we also said we'd missed working together.
You know, Father, you allude to the fact that your family was part of the Bush extended family, and you would vacation up at Kennebunkport. You're kind of like the pastor in A Prayer for Owen Meany, who gets invited every year out to the island. I don't know if you've read that. But your 14-year-old son walks out in his boxer shorts, brushing his teeth, and HW pats him on the head and said, make sure you use the jet ski. What do your kids think about them now? I mean, it's been a few years since that. They're probably all adults. What do they think about him now?
They are. I think they feel that way. They felt like they were fortunate to be brought into under the wings of two people who they felt were another set of grandparents or another great aunt and uncle, because from the moment they met them, they were treated like that. And I think because of the fact that they really did not watch their presidency as children, it took a while for them to kind of realize the scope of who they were. But they were never treated in any way other than welcome to the family and glad to have you around. And they would, again, when we would visit with the president or Barbara, they would always inquire about the kids and what they were up to and how they were doing. And they warm affection for them. I don't know anybody who was around them who didn't have that warm affection for them.
I've never had the experience of anyone not like, I never understood 92. People get upset about elections. I remember driving home. I was my first presidential election in 1992, and I'd been on the radio all night long, and Bill Clinton had won, and I just couldn't believe that America didn't want George H.W. Bush back. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but it was a turning point. And servant leadership came back with W. I really believe that. But let's close by talking about servant leadership as embodied by H.W. What, and Barbara, what did it mean to you?
I've said this a couple of times, Hugh, because people will say, what did you learn in the experience of serving them for 11 and a half years, but also in kind of reliving it in the writing of the book. And what it, you know, I always kind of came away from a visit with them wanting to be a better Christian, wanting to be, even in my vocation, even wearing this, I thought I could do a lot more than I'm doing, because look at these people who, even in their last years, you know, they were giving of themselves. I give that little vignette in the book where Barbara in the end was struggling with some back pain, you know, and the president went from walking with a cane to walking with a walker to a wheelchair. They still came to church, and you know, Barbara would slip into church and put a prayer book behind her back so that she could sit through my long sermons, which occasionally she referred to. So that it was a little long, you know, and I would think, I hope I'm that way in my senior years. I hope I'm that way now. And I would leave them thinking, I need to do more with the life God has given to me.
This is going to inspire people to be one of those thousand points of light, Father. And I just want people to know, witness to dignity obviously is an effort of love, but it's also a portrait that will be memorable and much beloved. And I hope it's flying off the shelves. I hope because if you want to give an apologetic to your aging parent who don't really know the Lord and don't really care to find out, but they do like politics, this is a good trick, Father. It's a very good trick.
Thank
well
you.
Done.
Whatever we can use. So
well done. And if I ever get to Houston, I've only been once. I went down there when South Texas School offered me a job. I said, they got tunnels for people in the summer here above ground. I'm not going to live there in Houston. But if I ever come to Houston, I'm going to come worship at St. Martin's, because you've written an amazing book, and I hope it sells a lot and that people are touched by it, as both my wife and I were. Thank you for writing it, Father.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on. I hope we can do it again sometime.
I look forward to it. That is the Reverend Russell J. Levinson, Jr., author of Witness to Dignity. Thank you much. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Dwayne. Thank you, Jacob. We will be back tomorrow with the radio show and Monday with the next edition of Grand Old Pod. But you got to subscribe to the universe. If you're going to listen to this, this is free today, but it's not going to be free next week. The Grand Old Pod is only available to people who pay to join the universe. And that's not unfair, because these people have to work harder to do that. And you need to know what I know about what's happening in the Republican Party. Thank you. Have a great weekend. Merry Christmas to you. Talk to you on the next Hugh Hewitt Show. Foundation deep somehow. Now but I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.